trickle in?
Huh? Look at that. Yeah. Yeah, let them trickle in.
All right.
Tell them a few minutes, we'll start.
Okay. We're going to let people come in slowly, so we'll delay the starting time by 5 minutes. Welcome to the Safe and Slow Strategies for a Changing World Forum, sponsored by the League of Women Voters of San Luis Obispo County. My name is Marguerite Bader, and I am president of the League of Women Voters of San Luis Obispo County. Let us begin with the Pledge of Allegiance. Under the guidance of the County Sheriff's Department, young people aged 14 to 21 can experience law enforcement as a potential career. These are the explorers. Would the explorers come forward and lead us in the pledge, please?
To the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. You may be seated.
The League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan organization which encourages informed and active participation in government. We are very busy with voter service, especially in an election year. You can find out what candidate forums we are staffing by going to our website, lwvslo.org, clicking on calendar. We also aim to increase understanding of major public policy issues and engage in education and advocacy. This forum would be an educational effort. Our national position on social policy states that we support the health and safety of all Americans. Whether your concerns are international terrorism, school and workplace shootings, or other events, tonight we plan to help you gain perspective, learn what you can do as an individual, and discover the ways our public safety officers plan and prepare for every eventuality. During the presentations, you can write questions for the panelists on the card runners hand out and collect. Besides our panelists, we have special guests here who can address any concerns you may have regarding Cal Poly campus safety and Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant. Hand your questions in before the break. Our moderator, Mary Lee Hyman, who is sitting to my left, will pose them to the panelists and special guests after the break. I'd like to mention, acknowledge that we have two guests here who are very relevant to our discussion tonight. Brigadier General retired Russ Howard. Put your hand up, please. Thank you, General. And Ron Alsop, the County Office of Emergency Services Director. Thank you, Ron. Um, During the break, there is a housekeeping note. There are restrooms as you go out of this chamber to the left, about halfway down the hall. And there are pocket-sized cards created by the Department of Homeland Security on the table outside that you may want to take home with you, as well as registration materials, because this is the year you want to be registered. And we also have Join the League leaflets, including one with pictures of men in the league. 30% of our members are league, are men. And keep that in mind. Don't let it stop you from being a member of the League of Women Voters. Now I would like to introduce our facilitator, Jim Petroni. Jim has lived in our county for almost years, I don't know, and served as fire marshal for the city of San Luis Obispo. I'm just giving a short resume because he has a very long one. And he once ran for San Luis Obispo Harbor Commissioner. He became involved in counterterrorism in its early stages in the U.S. and gives presentations to international groups on a regular basis. He has visited 65 countries doing this and drove from Monterey to be here tonight. So, Jim, it's up to you.
Thank you very much. Well, good evening, everybody, and again, it is a pleasure to be here and an honor and something I really believe in. As Marguerite mentioned, I've lived in this area for a long time, late 60s, and have always been involved in public safety. I had 10 years with the San Luis Fire Department, was an arson investigator, was the first EMT in the county, and had the wonderful opportunity to go from there to work for the California Specialized Training Institute, which is in this county, but it's a very unique organization, and was at the time that I joined it as the only school in the country to even address the topic of terrorism to mixed civilian audiences. I had 23 wonderful years there, helped develop a lot of the disaster methodologies, wound up as chief of the Emergency Management and Criminal Justice Programs, and after I left there, I retired in 2002, I wound up doing what I'm doing now, which is primarily doing emergency management, but mostly counterterrorism strategy level training and education to mostly foreign military audiences. So I only say that to provide some context for what I'm going to talk about and how I relate to this topic. I really like the community I live in. I love this place. And so as Marguerite and I had talked, and she told me that the League had been hearing from citizens that they were very concerned about the potential threat of terrorism, we thought, well, why are they that concerned? What do they think is going to happen? And worse yet, do they have an idea how we will respond to that? And so this is what was essentially the basis for this whole the session tonight. So what we're going to do is talk about some of that more background. I'll talk a little bit about the international situation, and I want to kind of give you a very broad overview, a very strong, a very robust system, protective system that is in place. And then, which I think is extremely important for local citizens, is to get to know who those people are and how they'll operate. So to that end, we have the panel that we assembled here, and just a very quick introduction, if I may. I'll start at the end. Deanna Cantrell may not be known to many of you yet. I hope that changes. She is our brand new chief of police in San Luis Obispo. You've been here how long now?
4 months.
4 months. She came from Mesa, Arizona, which already tells us they miss her very much. We're not going to let her go back. I think she's going to be an excellent chief for us. Our conversations so far have been very, very positive and reassuring, and she spoke recently on the radio, and to great reviews for that. If I can kind of move up in our layers of our system, I think everybody here does know our Sheriff Ian Parkinson, who's been a longtime member, former San Luis Police, moved up to the sheriff's position, and is very well known and very well liked. Next to him is Dr. Jim Brescia, who is our Superintendent of County Schools. And we've had some good talks on this topic, and I'll make a special comment in a minute here about the role of the schools in terrorism, why we're even bringing them in and addressing that. And then in the middle down there, kind of the young, handsome-looking young man there. That's Brian Sullivan. Brian is the Senior Supervising Special Agent for the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and he essentially manages the Santa Maria office, which is the regional office and representation of the FBI. So what we'll do is we'll ask, very soon, we'll ask each of these individuals to make a couple of comments on how they see this as a problem, how they relate to the community, and perhaps highlight some of the special functions and actions of their respective agencies and how they do this. So that's the very quick overview. We will, after they have made their comments and posited some points out there for you, we would like to hear questions from the audience. And again, Marguerite, they are to put them in writing. They have the materials to do that. We will close. We'll take a break. And during that break, we'll kind of sort things out, and then we'll come back and engage in response to those questions and dialogue and discuss this. So we hope to use this to get information out, and we hope that the end result is that you and the audience watching this have a much better understanding of how we approach this problem and how we deal with these things. Now, if I may describe essentially how we as a system, and I include myself in this even though I'm kind of retired now, but how we deal with this. First off, I think it's obvious that we don't just sit here and wait and something happens and we do something. There is a whole phase or a wide spectrum of activity that the system, our government system, does long before anything happens. And we refer to that as preparedness, and it could include everything from analysis and understanding of the problem to the steps we take to plan and identify resources that we have to apply to it. And I like to talk about a phase that in my field we tend to talk about as mitigation, and that's where we do things before an incident that we hope can prevent the incident, or if we can't prevent it, that's a phase in which we prepare to be able to better respond and the consequence of any event that should happen. Obviously, after that, should we fail in prevention and not be able to do that? Response. And most people only start their thinking about this in considering the response phase. But that is not the sole area of effort for us, and it is not where we devote an awful lot of our time. And we do, certainly, but we devote it to all these other areas. And then lastly, and this is also not usually appreciated by people until something happens, is what we call the recovery phase. And that's a very crucial thing where we try to restore the community to some sense of pre-incident normality. Very difficult to do. Now, I want to emphasize that because in large part, there are many roles that the schools play, and they represent a huge portion of our population, obviously. But one of the things in my quite a few years now of working this is an appreciation for the role that the schools do in recovery. Again, our most fragile potential victims of these incidents are our children. They are easily affected by this, and if we do not appropriately deal with them, again, problems are manifest later. So this is what we are particularly interested in. Now, clearly, the schools have other roles, and he'll address, Dr. Brescia will address some of the actions that his office is taking in conjunction with the local districts to help us prepare, and of course we'll talk about the response. So we will ask each of these individuals to talk about the activities of their department, their agency, relative to those three things. What do we do before? What do we do during? And what do we do after these events? Again, the topic that has brought us here tonight is that of terrorism. That's certainly not the only threat, believe me. And as a man who has conducted comparative risk assessments in 40 to 50 countries and for 30 years, I have a pretty good appreciation of relative risk, relative threat. Terrorism is certainly something we need to be concerned about. But, of course, why does terrorism work? Fear. It's not necessarily account, which is how we tend to measure incidents, but it's that intangible, it's the fear. And if you talk to people in the aftermath of these events, the ones who are not necessarily killed directly, part of the major problem is that they could not understand who was doing what to try to make this go away, where their families were, what their actions were going on, activity. So we will try to provide you with a sense of the system and how it works, and also kind of charge you individually with the responsibility to become engaged in this and understand it and do a few things. My son, who's in his 30s, a product of our local schools, by the way, left for Europe the day after the recent Brussels attack. Dad was not happy about that. Dad had a little talk with him, and he responded as young adults do with, "Oh, Dad." But he's well aware of my concerns, and he's been with me in a lot of the talking. But the idea is that we established a mechanism so I knew exactly where he was at all times. And so should something have happened while he was there, I would know very quickly that he wasn't anywhere near it. And that is the easy way for me to reduce my potential fear. Well, the same will carry out when you think of the loved ones that you're concerned about in society working around here now. If you know what they're going to do when something happens, and if you know what the system is going to do, you become more resilient, more immune, so to speak, from the fear potential of terrorism as we've described it. So that's a quick sense of what we're going to try and do here. Let me talk a little bit about the system, and I'll try to establish kind of a framework for some of these discussions. First off, America is very, very unusual in the sheer number of law enforcement agencies we have. We have the number that's usually used is 18,000 different law enforcement agencies. Now, you can see several of them here, but you recognize also there's park police, there's other police agencies, there's highway patrol. So nationwide, this is tremendous. Now, no other country comes close. I think the only, I believe, my recollection's a little fuzzy right now, but I believe it's the UK, primarily England, that has quite a few numbers, but nothing like this. It's a bit redundant, but it relates to something that we call home rule. Americans like to be in charge of their own protection and destiny. So we have all these different departments and over a million law enforcement officers. But they are layered, as we said, and they are also coordinated in a fashion that most people aren't aware. So what we'll talk about a little bit is that systems. Clearly we have here, for example, our local police department. And of course there are local police departments in the county. Part of the coordination role of dealing with those things in the event of an incident is what we call the Area Mutual Aid Coordinator for Law Enforcement, which is our sheriff in the sheriff's department. If he needs assistance, he is able to draw on mutual aid law enforcement throughout the rest of the state, which can be a very substantial number. Part of my job for a while working for the State Office of Emergency Services was filling those requests, and I have a real appreciation for how fast we can bring resources in. So that's part of that system. Now, that's the response aspect of it. But if we talk also about intelligence, which is how in that preliminary phase we would try to identify a problem and perhaps deal with it before it is actually a response incident, once again, we have developed, and I have been talking on the subject of intelligence and been involved in it to some degree since the 1970s, we have now done an awful lot in this country to engage the communities in this. And you probably heard a phrase that not, frankly I haven't heard much lately, but the see something, say something. Well, who do you tell it to? And what happens if you get information to somebody? So part of what you need to appreciate and understand is that if a citizen sees something, we want them to contact their law enforcement agency. So, for example, officer in the street in San Luis Obispo, good relations with the community, receives a piece of information. A lot of times that is converted into something they call a SAR, Suspicious Activity Report. Don't know, look kind of weird, maybe look at it. That then moves up into the system. Through law enforcement, it winds up going perhaps through the sheriff or others, into what we call nationally now our RTACs, or Regional Threat Assessment Centers. And there are many of them around the country. Unfortunately, not a real uniform standard, but they're all functioning to some degree. The one that we work with in this part of California is the Joint Regional Intelligence Center. Very good, sharp group of people. They receive this information, and they'll look at it, and they'll examine it and validate it. If it turns out to be something of significance, they don't investigate it. Instead, they hand it over to the next layer, which is typically our Joint Terrorism Task Forces. Those are run by the FBI, and they're the ones who will investigate cases and, if necessary, bring them to the U.S. Attorney for possible prosecution. So that's the sense of how we do that. And, of course, at the national level, there again, that agency is the one that often has the direct linkages to international other law enforcement agencies and other parts of our intelligence community to ensure that information from overseas is received, managed, and passed down back down to the locals as necessary. So it's quite a job of managing all these entities and resources and coordinating them. But again, there is a system that is getting better and better all the time at doing that. I was asked to talk a little bit about the international situation. And again, I have been in over 60 countries working, not for vacation, unfortunately. And I have a real appreciation of what's out there and have also had constant contact with representatives from 100 more countries in addition to that. And the last 2 weeks, I've been working with, I think I've calculated as I drove down here tonight, about 22 different countries, all who are here to work with us on their terrorism issues and problems. And you realize how limited our actual experience has been with terrorism. People always ask, is an international terrorist going to come and attack us here? And they say, is that going to happen? I say, well, you know, it's possible, but it's not probable. It's not very likely. I don't want to get into a big statistical review, but if you are, I hope, encouraged to look at statistics, you'll find that, frankly, the number of incidents of terrorism, especially foreign nationals coming in here, is very minimal. Certainly an event like September 11, 2001, where I lost friends, is, we hope, the rare exception. In most cases, the relatively minimal amount of terrorism we have seen has come from U.S. citizens and often from not ideology-based or not theologically-based, but right-wing individuals out of our own growth, out of our own country. So the fear works. If we believe what, you know, is often advertised, you need to really look at this and appreciate that that's a very low threat potential. It doesn't mean things can't happen. And that's the idea that if things happen, we have a system that is very good and can respond to that. One of the things that I wanted to get across, since I've been given the opportunity to speak on this, is your responsibility. I mean, a lot of times we ask this law enforcement and the government sector to deal with issues that are really not in their domain. A lot of these are social issues that we have created as a society, and they create problems, and then we expect them to make them go away. You know, I mean, we have to ask ourselves, how are we raising our children, our grandchildren? How are we influencing things? What movies do we choose to look at and support? You know, this influences a lot of things that go on in our society. We need to be a little smarter about a lot of this. You know, I was very dismayed to find that probably the most largest selling genre of video games is called first-person shooter. That's not a good sign. You know, that's kind of an indicator of how our society kind of cultivates this potential for violence. So I want to charge all of us as individuals with acting intelligently and responsibly and being aware of the influences we individually make on this collective society we're in. So the other thing that we often talk about, you know, again, how we interact with each other, one of the things I like very, very much about the League of Women Voters is their emphasis in their programs on civil discourse. And, of course, this year we have all seen examples of rather uncivil discourse. And I think that's very, very sad. I regret that. But we can change that individually. Collectively, our inputs to the system, the way we react to all of that, can influence it substantially. So that's a little bit of philosophical, you know, approach on this that I would like to put out there. One of the other rules that I've often quoted on, and but is applicable to this whole topic, whether it is terrorism or other events, and you mentioned, introduced Ron Alsop, who is an old friend of mine and a very good proponent for preparedness, but I like to use a rule called the 90% rule. And remember that rule. 90% rule says, when the crisis occurs, a terrorist attack, earthquake, whatever, 90% of the opportunities that you'll ever will have had to change the outcome of that event are already gone. You can't prevent it. You can't prepare anymore for it. You can't do any of those things. All that you have, knowledge of where people are, knowledge of the system, that's right at that moment, and it's never going to be enough. So I want citizens to become more engaged, more knowledgeable, and better prepared, whether it's for terrorism or any other kind of incident or event. So I think that's probably pretty much enough out of me for now. But I feel strongly about it. And again, I don't usually do community engagement talks locally, but this is my town. And I felt that this was a very appropriate opportunity to try to talk to you and try to influence that. What I would like to do now is, again, give you a little bit of time to hear from our colleagues here. And I think I'd like to start, if it's all right, with Chief Cantrell. And, again, we've talked about this, and what we hope, again, is that they will all talk a little bit about the actions they do beforehand in their department, beforehand, during, and in the aftermath of an event. Deanna, thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Good evening, and I'll talk a little bit about some of the things that Jim already mentioned, and I'll start with really the how we prepare and how we prevent, and part of that certainly does start with our relationships with our community, relationships with our community, our city officials, other city departments with transportation and fire and public works and those types of things, and then, of course, our relationship with other law enforcement agencies, both federal, state, county, and otherwise. So in San Luis Obispo, we have 60 sworn officers, and certainly 60 sworn officers cannot be responsible for every bit of safety and every person's safety in the city. People do have a role in their own safety and have a responsibility, in taking care of themselves to a degree. And so that's really an important thing that I think Jim started to touch on there, was that we can't do it alone, and that the community really does have to be our eyes and ears in so many ways, not just with terrorism or an act of violence or during a disaster, but also just everyday, day-to-day with crime and things that are happening in our communities. So it starts out with that relationship. One of the things that the San Luis Obispo Police Department has is called Neighborhood Officers, and that was created so that we could start to build that foundation and that relationship with people, and so that people in our community would know officers, would know them by name, and would recognize them, and vice versa, that officers would know community members by name, and it wouldn't just be a title or a uniform that you see, but you would actually know somebody as a human being, which really does change our relationship. And so I would start there with relationships, and I think that is a huge piece to us being prepared for when a critical incident does happen in our city. Next, I would say education is probably the next most important thing, and not only education for our community and how our community can prepare themselves, but also education for us as a law enforcement agency. We do a lot of training. We do a lot of disaster preparedness. We train jointly with each other, and we also train within the city with other city departments. This year, the San Luis Obispo Police Department did training for all other city departments in active shooter, as well as with the San Luis Obispo school system. We are still working on doing active shooter training with our other soft targets, with our hospitals. We have training set up with Sierra Vista coming up later this month, and our schools, churches, government buildings and other places that would have multiple victims in those kind of locations. And so that's part of that training, not just training with the community so that they can have that experience, but we have a regional SWAT team, and we do a fair amount of training together. We share equipment and resources on a regular basis. So first, relationships, next, education and training, and part of that education besides us training is for the community to understand their role in their own safety. And that is just really by understanding what the signs are, what looks suspicious and what doesn't. We're all very smart. All of you, I'm sure, have had the hair on the back of your neck stand up at some point, and you thought, that doesn't look right. Something about that just doesn't look right. And a lot of times people will not call law enforcement. You won't call the police because you don't want to bother us. And that's the wrong road to take. We really would rather you called us. We'd really rather you picked up the phone and let us decide if what you're seeing is suspicious or not. But if you don't make that phone call, it very well could be a very crucial thing that you're seeing. So we really would like you to call us. Trust yourself and trust your instincts because they probably are right. Knowing the signs about your coworkers, if you have a coworker that is starting to use a lot of sick time or talking about violence in the workplace and things like that, those are always really important. And I think Marguerite printed out some information that would be very, very helpful for those of you that have businesses or anywhere you work to take the information that's on the tables outside back with you, because I think people could learn from that. Understanding the principles of run, hide, and fight. I think that's being taught, and most people have heard those terms and understand exactly what that means. And so education is going to be a big key of being prepared. Next, I would say, is the enforcement part of this and intelligence gathering. And the enforcement part of it is with officers, us going out into the community and being actively engaged and not just responding to calls for service, but hopefully having enough time that we can do proactive work and getting out in contact people that were not necessarily called on, but that look suspicious to us. And so that is critical. And then the intelligence gathering piece, there is a lot of work that's done on social media, and I'm sure that will be talked about at some point this evening. We have work that we do in that regard. But other intelligence gathering through the Joint Regional Information Center, which was mentioned already, JTTF and some of our federal partners, and that sharing of information is really critical for us. And then technology, we try to use technology as much as possible. It is certainly a force multiplier for us. We can't be everywhere all the time, and so the use of cameras and social media monitoring systems and systems that help our records managements and our people, our detectives and whatnot, be able to communicate better with each other is a critical piece. So that's kind of the preparedness part, and then I'll talk a little bit about if an incident were to happen here in San Luis, and then I'll pass that on probably to Sheriff Parkinson, because he would be, of course, one of my first phone calls. So if we had an incident, and whether it was a disaster, an active shooter, we planned a lot for flooding this year with thoughts that might happen. And so regardless of what kind of emergency it is, it would certainly start with our dispatch communications center. Calls would come flooding in, and both fire and police would be dispatched to that location. And so we would respond, and many, many things would be happening all at once. Officers would be responding, sergeants, lieutenants, the highest ranking person would be responding. We would activate what's called the incident command system, and our tactical operations center, or our emergency operations center, which is at the fire station at, I think, Fire Station 1. And so we would be doing a lot of assessments about what is the emergency, what are our immediate needs, how many victims are there, what kind of threat is it, Is it a train that's derailed, and is it a chemical type thing, or is it an active shooter? Those kinds of questions would all be being answered very quickly. And then we would be making a very fast determination about what resources do we have at our fingertips, what are we able to immediately deploy, and we would be making phone calls to our partners because we have mutual aid agreements with each other, and we would be getting resources coming in from around the county and even from around the state, depending on how the incident is. I think is that a good place to pass it off?
I think at that point it's kind of a logical handoff. We've kind of described, at least in the response phase, how it starts big and gets bigger and bigger. Like you said, first call, going to be the sheriff. So, sir, perhaps you could respond and talk about the preparedness response activities.
Certainly. I just want to begin and thank the League of Women Voters. This is a great opportunity for both the people in the room and the audience that might view this to understand it and possibly prepare and react. So thank you, and also to the people that have chosen to come. I think that's a very key part, and I think it's kind of been mentioned a couple times about how important it is to connect to the community and for the community to understand what you're doing. That's kind of where some of the comfort lies. So I just want to start and just kind of give you a real brief understanding of history and the office of sheriff and where it kind of comes into play. So California back in 1850 became a state, and part of the becoming a state was the California Constitution and the adoption of local government, which included the office of sheriff, the Board of Supervisors, and by the way, I think I have 4/5 vote up here to vote on our budget a little later, so I think I'm going to do really well this year. They don't know it yet. And the district attorney are several of the offices. So the Constitution of California is really what has established the office of sheriff. And it's unique in the sense that it is a independent office. And when California first began, there was 27 original counties, and believe it or not, little San Luis was one of them. There's 58 counties now, so some of the counties split. San Luis County virtually remained the same. And the duties of the sheriff are dictated by law, again, in the government code and the Constitution, but it's unusual in the sense that, as many of you probably already aware, that the sheriff's responsible for maintaining a jail. The sheriff has the bailiffs in the courtroom. We have a civil division that's responsible for evictions and other processes. We have the coroner. I'm the coroner as well. So it's a different role from regular traditional law enforcement, but it's independent, and it's some of those duties are dictated. The interesting thing, if you go back to 1850 on this topic that we're talking about now, not a lot has changed. I know that sounds a little strange, but the first sheriff of San Luis County, Henry Daly, had some of the same challenges we do, and that is how do you respond to major events, and how do you manage them and deal with them? Because no matter what the event that we're talking about here, whether it's an attack on some structure, a water plant, Diablo Canyon, whatever it is, it's our fundamental responsibility of both police officers in the county and deputy sheriffs to respond and manage chaos. The chaos is the same. That's what we do every day. We go into an event and we manage it. We try to stabilize it, and we try to deal with the recovery of that event the best we can. Now, when we start talking about a terrorism event, whether it's domestic or foreign, like what occurred in San Bernardino, it is the same type of thing that we deal with every day, but on a larger level. So obviously with that comes our desire to be more prepared, both from a law enforcement response, but also as a community in how we react to that event. because it's not like a domestic violence call or a smaller disturbance call where the deputy or officer goes out and stabilizes and does all those things and leave. It's a lot more involved in that. And there's a lot more preparation because it's so unusual. So I think Chief Cantrell mentioned, and it's so vital, and you're probably going to hear this so many times it's going to get old, but it's all about partnerships. And whether our partnerships are with law enforcement, with our schools, or with our community, it's the same. We're all partners in this because it's not something that is managed solely by law enforcement. We need the community. We need the community to understand it, and we need the community to be prepared with us as well. The challenge, and this is the hippopotamus in the room here, and that is how do we underreact, or do we underreact or overreact? And if you look at all the events, we have two common, I think, terminology or two common denominators, is an underreaction where the community says, you guys were not prepared for this event. How do you prepare yourself for San Bernardino? It used to be that we prepared ourselves by focusing in on school shootings is a real common one. That is really important to all of us because we have innocent, probably the most innocent victims in the world are our children. And so we worry about that. But look how that dynamic has changed over the last few years. And the most recent one in San Bernardino, who would have thought that a fellow employee would have left a Christmas party or a party of any sort and come back armed and killing people? So as much as we train in one area and our focus is schools, and I know we're going to have that discussion about what we've done, and I think those are very informative to you topics. I think the reality is we have to kind of apply that to everything, because right now there are no rules. And that means that every single area of our life, whether we go to Costco, whether we go to, you know, the small grocery store, whether we go to, you know, drop our kids off at school, we go to the county government center, whatever it is, that event could happen there. And so I think the danger that we get into sometimes is we discuss underreaction, that we weren't truly prepared, and we don't sometimes discuss enough overreaction. And we see snippets of that on the news. We see snippets of that in politics. An example would be the militarization of law enforcement. I've heard that word quite often. And I've often asked back, what does that mean? What is the militarization of law enforcement? Because the last time I looked in the mirror, I'm wearing a uniform, and that is paramilitary. And we are fundamentally built on a military system. But when we start rolling out, you know, the military-looking vehicles, we become this militarized law enforcement. The challenge is it an overreaction, or is it an overreaction by a certain group of in the population to it? Because if I asked you today at Diablo Canyon, I need equipment, specialized equipment, to respond to any event that happened at Diablo Canyon, I think most people in this county would say, Sheriff, you can have what you want. You know, take what you need because we want Diablo protected. I think realistically, I think our reaction sometimes, we overreact in both a negative and positive way. We look at our relations within our community, particularly when we have a foreign terrorism attack, and I think we tend to group everybody into one category as terrorists. And the truth is if you look across the board at some of our most horrific terrorism acts that have occurred, and I think it's already been mentioned, and I'm sure it'll be mentioned again, they're not from anywhere but the United States. So I think the key in figuring this out, and this is the issue that I think we really have to focus on, is we can tell you everything that we are doing to prepare, and I think when you see some of the things that we're doing here locally, I think it's pretty impressive. I really do, because I have the conversations with the 57 other sheriffs, and I know what they're doing locally compared to what we're doing. But I think the thing that we can't lose focus on is when we talk about overreacting. And what does that really mean? Is there such a thing? And what is that? And how do we manage that? So I'll stop talking. I'm sure there's going to be tons of questions or at least direction. So I'll pass the mic.
Thank you, sure. Appreciate it. And again, he covered a wide range of topics there. But believe me, his role in this is very, very crucial, not just as a provider of direct resources, but the coordination role they can do, the ability to surge in and assist and manage this is of great import. One of the things I will mention is that, you know, terrorism often is so disturbing, not because necessarily the quantity of deaths or injuries that may happen, but it's the terror aspect of it. So it's an event that is different not only in degree, but mostly difference in kind. It makes it very hard for the society to accept it and to work with it, and as part of the requirement we talked about. The other thing, as they've mentioned, the incident command system is an example of systems that we have developed over years that have application to lots of problems, and they solve lots of issues for us. So our communication systems and also this command structure is a way for us to knit all these resources together and bring them to bear where we need to. But if I may, I'll go kind of further up the law enforcement chain one more time here, and let me ask Brian Sullivan, our special agent from Santa Maria, to make his comments. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Jim, very much, and also thank you to the League of Women Voters for having us here tonight and hosting this great event. We do appreciate it. Coming from the FBI at a 30,000-foot view, and not a lot of people have the opportunity to deal with the FBI, I often find myself having to be careful, say, having access to classified material, and in an act of not being redundant over the reoccurring themes I've come across, I'm very cautious in what I say. And I'll share with you a funny little story that I'm reminded of this very notion of being careful what I say daily as I welcomed new neighbors to my neighborhood yesterday morning. I hadn't had a chance to meet them, and as they pulled up, the husband got out of the car and greeted me in my driveway, and his wife and their dog to their house. And I spoke with him, and he's a retiree from Marin County, and had a nice conversation. He said, "Yeah, that's my wife. That's Rose, and that's Gigi." And after about 5 minutes, the wife decided to walk over and introduce herself. And I extended my hand, trying to be a gentleman. I said, "Hey, Rose, pleasure to meet you." And she looked me dead in the eye. "I'm Gigi." So I try to think before I speak, if I could. What I'd like to do, if you'll allow me to, is I'll just give you an overview of the organization as a whole, the FBI as a whole, then how it transfers down to Los Angeles and to Santa Maria and to my territory. I'd like to talk a little about some reoccurring themes we've seen, and I'd like to talk a little about how we integrate with the local law enforcement at this level. The FBI as a whole is an organization of 35,000 people, 13,000 special agents and 22,000 professional support employees. We have a direct funded budget of $9 billion. We have 56 field offices located throughout the United States. And supporting those field offices, we have 400 smaller resident agencies that support them. We're located in 63 foreign countries, our legal attaché's offices. And as we transfer down to where we're at now, we're operating under Director Comey's priorities. He's established 10 priorities, and those priorities from Washington, D.C. extend down to me in lowly Santa Maria, and I follow the boss's direction. Now, they won't be as pronounced in this area. We don't see a lot of international terrorism, but I'll tell you that is the number one priority of the FBI. Every agent, regardless of what you're currently working, is a counterterrorism agent at heart. Secondly, it funnels down to preventing counterintelligence, and thirdly, it gets down into cyber attacks. Those are the three things that plagues Director Comey and the FBI, and those are our three greatest threats to the United States right now. When I speak of Los Angeles, our second largest field office, that's my parent office, we are covering 9 counties of Los Angeles, of which San Luis Obispo is one of the 9. We cover nearly 7.5 million people. And in that office, we have 9 resident agencies, of which Santa Maria is one of those resident agencies. And that's the office I run down in Santa Maria. I have approximately 15 agents and a handful of local partners that work with us as well. We have the sole responsibility of all of San Luis Obispo County. We have half of Santa Barbara County. Unfortunately, I talked to my counterpart down in Ventura, the working half of Santa Barbara County. He has the affluent half of Santa Barbara County. I stop at the Gaviota Tunnel. We have the responsibility of 5,000 square miles. It's almost the same territory that the sheriff has. There's 700,000 people in our territory that I'm responsible for on a federal level. We have interests of all capacities, from Diablo to three military installations. We have three prison complexes. We have a host of cleared contractors running out here with top secret clearances. And we have many other assets of federal responsibility we have. But that doesn't preclude us from getting involved in local matters as well. And we do it quite often. So how do we take Director Comey's vision, all of his money and his resources, and work closely with our partnerships? And we've been able to do this exceptionally well. I like to use the term wicker, because we are essentially wickered in with all of the local departments and agencies. We do it in two ways. We do it in a formalized and non-formalized task forces, working groups, and intelligence centers. And then we do it, as the sheriff said, the hippopotamus in the room is partnerships. And that's what we do it. I've always said, and I will continue to say, one of the many ways the FBI is measured is by how it has developed its partners and how it works with its partners. And I can say, hands down, we are exceeding in this category in San Luis Obispo County. The sheriff knows, as well as Chief Cantrell knows, that they can at any moment call and levy the full authority and resources of the FBI. I will find a way to make it happen, and I rely on them for the same when my office needs assistance. So rest assured, that existing partnership is there. When I speak of the formalized partnerships and formalized task forces that we work under, as Jim mentioned before, we have the JREC, the Joint Regional Intelligence Center. Originally designed as a sole intelligence center gearing toward international terrorism matters. The interesting thing I'd like to point out about that is we have transitioned, and we've now incorporated all criminal elements in well, because, as again, it's been said, we don't know what we don't know. And that quote and that sentence haunts me. It's not that we're not prepared. It's not that we're not collecting on intelligence. It's not that we're not disseminating and sharing it. We just don't know when a guy's going to go to a Christmas party, get angry and leave and come back with two assault rifles. We don't know. Second way we do it is through our joint terrorism task forces. That's how we track the international terrorism task forces. We disseminate information, we collect information. And we have partners. These task forces are staffed by federal departments, they're staffed by local task force officers, and they're staffed by county and state as well. Everybody's included in these task forces. When I talk about partners, I talk about partnerships locally, criminal and terrorism-related matters. For example, in Santa Maria, we have a Safe Streets Task Force. And I'm proud to say that the sheriff, Sheriff Parkinson, has been on our task force with a full-time deputy for the past 8 years. We also have members of CHP and other local municipalities who are on our task force. We have terrorism liaison officers embedded in every department. A terrorism liaison officer, TLO, is an individual who typically retains a secret-level security clearance, and they are privy to any information we can disseminate to them. So there is no loss or lapse of information. The sheriff has a secret security clearance, and we've had to share with him information in the past that is at the secret level. So there is no stopgap. They have the information. And I tell you, we will ensure the right people have the information to go forward and do our job successfully. The one thing that's interesting, more so a theme that will be brought up again, is a commonality of resources. Even at the FBI level, we speak the same language as Chief and as the Sheriff. We operate under the same incident command. We operate and utilize and share each other's resources. And we practice and drill and go over our emergency procedures all the time. Ron, I know we have one coming up in September. So what can you expect? In light of a mass casualty incident, what could you expect? The FBI and all law enforcement essentially is an apolitical organization. We are not bound by parties. We are not told what to investigate. We investigate it all. We look at it, and we will make our best determination. Rest assured, regardless of what you see on the news, we are working hard at it. You can imagine it will be a lengthy investigation. I promise you it will be a lengthy investigation. You will see joint press releases with multiple faces, and you won't see anyone vying to take the lead role. Because the first 24 hours of mass confusion, as confusing as it is for you, it is confusing for us as well to understand. Not saying we're not in control. It's saying we're just trying to get a better handle on what it is. But it'll be time before a lead agency is designated, and that's how we want it. We want everybody showing up, and then we can start peeling back later on. And you'll see information through press releases, and it'll be informative, but I assure you it'll be slow and forthcoming. Because the FBI, as well as I know the sheriff is, we want to be informative, but we want to be factual. We will not rush and be wrong. That has happened in the past, and that is a no-good scenario. And simply, what do we ask of you? We ask that you communicate with us. You submit your tips to us. You reach out and you speak with an officer on a bike patrol in San Luis Obispo or a deputy at the airport you encounter. We need to hear from you. It is vital. Secondly, and I'm sure this, I believe this was said earlier, continue to live your life normal. In light of any incident that occurs, do not alter your path. I know Jim mentioned the word fear earlier. Do not alter your normal work or normal life. Fear is how individuals who conduct these types of crimes win. And that's all they're looking to do is cause confusion and fear. And thirdly, I need you to be a good witness. Report what you see. I know Chief Cantrell hit it, and I won't belabor the point, but be a good witness for us, please. As an example of the San Bernardino incident, the FBI conducted, and mind you, this is still an active and ongoing investigation. Just because it's no longer primetime news on Fox, it is still an active investigation that the FBI is working. They've conducted over 500 interviews. And a majority of those interviews were derived from tips and information that people sent in, such as yourselves in the audience. More importantly, we learned of Enrique Marquez from an individual on the street who said, you may want to take a look at this guy. Now, I'm not saying the FBI wouldn't have found Enrique Marquez by tracing back the weapons, but we learned of him sooner by somebody simply phoning in and telling us, hey, we should take a look at this guy. Your involvement and understanding of what you can do to aid us is as important, if not more important, than the investigation itself. I thank you guys for your time.
Very well said. Thank you very much. You know, my own experience, I've worked with the FBI at every level since the 70s, and that organization has changed and has, as he said, has become very much engaged in very close partnerships. I've never seen it work better than it is right now. And again, that's just it's something that it's a requirement, and it is you put a lot of work in, it's worked good. One of the problems has always been that we have the issue, or used to have an issue, with what we call concurrent jurisdiction. So if there was a homicide in one of the California communities, that's a violation of state law, and the local law enforcement agency would be in charge of that investigation. If aspects of that crime were violations of a federal statute, for example, terrorism, well, then the FBI would be the lead agency for response on that. And that used to be a bit of a problem. Who was in charge? We don't really see that anymore. We've worked it out. The collaboration is remarkable. For me, virtually a textbook example of this is the San Bernardino shooting, which was a very complex response, as you all saw. And then I was very pleased to see how it was presented, or how the public saw it, in terms of the agencies involved. And there was a very just an excellent sharing, which I do feel reduced the fear in the population substantially. And so that's what we're hoping to see. Obviously, we'd much prefer to prevent it. And as he talked about the good witness and coming forth with information, had somebody maybe made the call in the weeks, days prior to that incident that could have resulted in a prevention of that incident, so much better. But in all cases, it's that reliance on your input. But having said all of that, we've emphasized, again, the law enforcement community. We've kind of tried to describe how they operate and how they interact. But once again, we felt from the very beginning a key component of discussing how this community would deal in prevention, response, and recovery would be the role of the schools. Now, you all know there are multiple school districts in here, but again, we do have a central entity that is the kind of the coordinating entity over those. And so we were very pleased to be able to get Dr. Jim Breschew, who is our superintendent of the Office of County Education, And we'd like to hear from him now as to some of the programs they have going and their interaction with the districts and how they work in this whole system. Dr. Murphy?
Thank you, and thank you to the League of Women Voters for their continual push to engage the community in civic affairs. Our county is just about 4,000 square miles, Ian? Just under that, and that encompasses 10 school districts, several charter schools, about a half a dozen or so private and parochial schools spread out throughout the county, 35,000 school-age children. And my office, like the sheriff's, is a constitutional office. There are 58 of us across the state. And really, we are an oversight and a convening body. So aside from the fiscal and the and the mandated responsibilities, the coordination of safety rests with my office, but allowing each individual district or jurisdiction to have some autonomy. The challenge comes in that we are dealing with probably five different agencies. If you look at our county schools, like a Shandon, a Templeton, Miguel, they're dealing primarily with the sheriff's office because those fall outside of the incorporated territories of our county. And then you look at a district such as San Luis Obispo. It's very interesting. San Luis Obispo is dealing with three different entities. So San Luis Obispo proper, the school district, deals with the police department, San Luis Obispo Police Department. The campus in Morro Bay, the two campuses in Morro Bay are dealing with the Morro Bay Police Department. Then the Los Osos and Baywood are dealing with the Sheriff's Office. So it's very important that each of our districts works in coordination with law enforcement. We are not the law enforcement entity. They come on and really we at one point give some of our authority up to law enforcement when they enter our building. Work with us, but that communication piece is critical. My director of operations, Mr. Ashley Lightfoot, is here, and his job primarily is to work with each of the school district's operations transportation coordinators to facilitate a harmonious communication and sharing of resources. The county also has the opportunity to mobilize our assets in the event of an emergency. We have a bus fleet spread out across the county. We have facilities that will shelter individuals if we have to move. Having PG&E here and working with a nuclear power plant, there's a coordinated effort and a command center that the county operations emergency services coordinates and works with our department on. So really it is an effort across the county to work with each jurisdiction, each municipality, each law enforcement agency. And the Sheriff's Office has been excellent about bringing us all together, bringing the police chiefs, bringing the school district superintendents and safety officers to look at a proactive approach and a plan to dealing with any type of emergency. Recently we've had two in our county which involved the FBI. And I was very impressed with the coordinated effort of the Sheriff's Office, Tascadero Police Department, the FBI, all coming together, keeping information going and it flowing out. And as Jim was saying, the after effect, we understand that law enforcement comes in and helps with the immediate situation. Once that's resolved, then they exit. We then have to liaise with the county, with counseling agencies, with other entities to deal with the aftermath. We still have children that are receiving some sort of counseling and support from things from the Paschal's earthquake when a school was closed in the middle of the year, and things had to be, there's an implication of how do we deal with that afterwards. The Atascadero incident, a lot of fear on the parts of the families and the parents, and how's that? That's where the school system comes in, our counselors, our therapists, and we rely heavily upon external agencies to assist us in that. We have limited capacity in the short term, but I have to say our county is very good at stepping in and helping, as are many volunteer agencies that will provide support in the event of an emergency. Now, where this comes down to everyone else, and I'm only going to echo what my colleagues up here have said, is information. I would say far more incidents have been prevented by people saying something to school officials, which in turn coordinate with law enforcement, and we're able to prevent incidents of violence, incidents of hate crime, incidents that would now, under current definitions, be classified as terrorism, because someone's stepping forward to provide information. So that's where the public can help, and teaching our students when it's appropriate to discuss something and to share with a trusted individual. And I mean, my colleagues on the left and right here can tell me, I would say on a basis, one of our schools is probably in touch with law enforcement to discuss some information that has been presented to them, sometimes of minor nature and other times of very serious nature. I know as a school principal and as a superintendent, I worked closely with the school resource officer, both in the city and with the sheriff's office. Those individuals become members of our community and resources that we can rely on to provide a safe environment for all of our children. Our office is responsible not only for the government-funded schools, but then we also liaise with our private and parochial schools. Any building that's brick and mortar that has children in it, we coordinate emergency services and a contact. So during the fire, during the incident with the Atascadero last year, there was communication that went out to every educational establishment in the county in coordination with the Sheriff's Office, Atascadero PD, and the FBI. And that's part of the charge of our office.
Again, I gained an appreciation as when I used to work with a lot of the state earthquake preparedness programs for just what a large percentage of a normal community is involved or touched by the schools. Not only the children, the parents of the children, the siblings either above or beyond school age, the employees of the various districts, and it is a very substantial percentage of our community. So as a vehicle for communication, for discussion, for information exchange both directions, it's a appreciated aspect of who we are. The other thing, they've all talked about coordination here, and I really, I always joke with the students I work with, the attendees of our programs, and I say I can write often the after-action report for an incident before the incident ever occurs. I can write a couple of paragraphs, and one is going to say we need better coordination. It's almost always a crucial issue. I really hope you appreciate how much effort each of these people and their agencies into creating and maintaining that coordination that they've all spoken to. That is a hard thing. You got to work at it and keep it up. So I hope that is a point that you appreciate that they're all doing here. I think at this point, we're probably due for a quick break. Is that correct? So let's take a break, and you'll call us back in. Will you advise us?
Yes.
And we have, how are we dealing with the questions here? You can,
has everyone submitted questions that would like the panel to answer? Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Take that break then.
We'll take a break and come back in about 20 minutes. questions in 2 minutes, please.
Did you have a question?
I did. Oh, we're ready now. AGP videos.
You switch seats. Are you okay with this?
Oh, no. Well,
do you want to stay there?
I might as well because I got this laid out. I'm sorry. Don't joke. I'm not good at jokes. I sing? Oh, no. AGP video? Yes, I know. I'm giving a high sign to AGP video. We are being taped. In fact, we're live right now. And it will replay at some time not yet known because they have to get the whole thing in a can and time it. But go to SlowSpan, SlowSpan.org, and you can find out when this will be replayed because I'm sure you're going to want to tell a neighbor or two to tune into this. This is really valuable information for all of us. So let's get started with our first question, and I'm going to direct it at Chief Cantrell. The question is, citizen engagement and or education were mentioned. Is a program or structure in place to accomplish this? If not, what can we, should be, initiated?
We don't have anything in San Luis right now, but it is something that we are looking at in our strategic plan over the next 5 years. One of the things that we would like to do is start a citizen police academy, and I've actually talked to fire, and we've talked about making it a citizen public safety academy so that fire and police, so people in the community would get educated in both law enforcement activities and resources that we have available, and also fire, and understand both of our responses, not only to critical incidents, but that you get training, you'd go on ride-alongs, and things of that nature. So that is something that is coming. Many agencies in the nation have citizen police academies or public safety academies. So it isn't anything new to law enforcement, but it would be new to San Luis Obispo. So we'll get that started in the next few years.
Thank you very much. What have we learned from local cases is this category. There are two cases in terms of appropriate response to the immediate incident, application of prosecution of criminal justice system threats in this nature of overall threat to terrorism of the Central Coast. So it's a whole lot of things involved in this. Jim, would you like to field this?
Yeah, again, I've not been responsible for any, you know, of the responses to recent incidents, and I might actually ask my colleagues, both the chief who dealt with the incident of the bus threat, and again, perhaps you can talk about some of the other things, or even the school. Was the question about what? How did this system work for that?
Well, it's in multiple questions. It started that we've had at least three terrorist threats requiring coordinated response from the police and sheriff and other law enforcement agencies and the public. And the question is, what have we learned from these cases?
Yeah, I think Chief Cantrell and Sheriff Parkinson are probably the best to address that. So, Chief, you're my
sure.
Turn.
Yeah. So one of those incidents was in my first week when I was here, and it was a bomb threat on a bus. And, you know, it's interesting that Sheriff Parkinson brought up an over or under response to that. And so people can sometimes be very critical of that. We ended up coordinating with Public Works, with Transportation, with the Regional Transportation Authority, I think is what it's called. It was my first week, and it's only, you got to give me a break. It's only been 4 months. There's a lot of acronyms to learn. Yeah, RTA. It being my first week, it was one of the best things, honestly, that I could have experienced because it allowed my team that I didn't know very well yet, it allowed them to work with me and me to work with them in an emergency where we did not have mass casualties, but we had to work through the incident command system. And so very quickly, we were able to see my knowledge base and my experience level, and I was able to experience theirs very quickly. And so it was really actually one of the best experiences we could have had in the first week. And not only that, but I got to very quickly partner with San Luis Obispo Police Department. We don't have a canine unit or officer, but, so we had to borrow resources from other. And so very quickly, I met folks from the Sheriff's Office, from the National Park Service, from Camp San Luis, from we had people coming in from all of our agencies to help us with that incident because it very quickly exhausted our resources by shutting down all of the buses and having to protect areas and evacuate certain areas. And so it was a really very good experience.
Thank you. Sheriff?
Well, you know, I just want to add something that is kind of important and not specifically on the incident, but kind of the management of the incident that people don't always understand. So we are very fortunate, I would say, in this county to have a very robust Office of Emergency Services. Because of Diablo Canyon, our EOC, which is located out next to my main office on Highway 1, and really run by Ron Alsop here, that really allows us to manage an event. So when you hear somebody talk about ICS or an incident management system, really what we're talking about simply is a structure of managing an event. So no matter what that event is, the structure is very similar. So when we occupy our EOC, you're going to have, you know, Jim's people there. You're going to have FBI people there, the city there. So you're going to have literally every single person that represents an influence over that event there. And so it's managed on a much larger level. But because of Diablo, and this is my personal feeling and speaking with other sheriffs throughout the state, is that we do it better than most because we do it every single year and sometimes multiple times a year in practice. And whether you're practicing for Diablo, a tsunami, some type of hostile event, the reality is it gets us into that mode where we're constantly practicing coming together and coordinating things. If you take something like a tsunami, we had a few years ago, we had a tsunami warning on the coast and the EOC was activated and everybody came into their seats and we start discussing our response, our evacuation plan, and most of what we have in all honesty is covered in one of our books, because it's been planned and thought about. And so we open our book on evacuations or response. But the most important thing about it, the system itself, the management of the event, is that when you talk about an event that involves a school, we know that the school is sitting at the table when we discuss that. So the impacts on the school, the impacts on the roadway, the impacts on the city, all those different resources are all at the same table. So the coordination is actually pretty amazing to watch. And I think we're very fortunate here because when we have an event, depending on how the size of it, we're very well rehearsed at coming down, responding to the EOC, setting up our system, and responding to that. Because oftentimes what happens, and I think you mentioned it, is that, you know, after event, we go and re-examine it and say, what did we do, what right or what wrong? Well, communication is one of the big ones. It's like if you ask anybody what's at your job, what's the worst thing that is going on? What can improve at your employment? Most of the time people say communication. We need to have better communication. You can always improve that. But when it comes to an EOC, the whole idea in incident management is to get everybody at the table and talk about all these things. Because as the chief explained, something as simple as a bus line, We think about managing the event itself. We don't think about disruption to the bus line, all the people that are waiting at the bus stop for that bus, all those people that have to get on that bus to get to work and now are late and their business can't open. So something as simple as that is really a disaster in a lot of ways. So it's the management of that and getting that clear understanding, I think, is where we really excel in this county. And a lot of it is a direct result of PG&E and Diablo, that the mandates are there, and it causes us to rehearse this over and over and over again.
Somebody else like to chime in on this one? Jim?
If I may.
Yes.
Again, being outside the system, I can talk about as an observer with knowledge and background. The sheriff just mentioned communications as being one of those chronic points that's always looked at. Communications is often thought of when we talk about it like that as a technical issue. Do we have the radio channels? Do we have the phone lines? Communication also is highly dependent upon the interpersonal communication. And that's what I hope people appreciate from hearing from these people, is that there is a very collegial and coordinated interagency communication that exists all the time, that becomes of tremendous value when you're in the crisis mode. You mentioned exercises. I've probably done more than anybody you'll ever know. That was my career. I've done over 2,000 worldwide, and I'm very good with what I know about how we operate here. So again, the assurance is these things are tough, but we have a system, and that system is populated, is composed of people and agencies that are very used to working with each other and very easy to work with each other. That's a very strong plus for us.
Thank you. This next question has to do with a cyber attack. How vulnerable are we here on the Central Coast to a coordinated cyber attack on our communications and infrastructure? Isn't an attack of this type more likely and more dangerous? And a second part to the question, how is law enforcement staying abreast or ahead of these kinds of challenges? Agent Sullivan, would you like to tackle this one first?
I had a feeling you were looking at me for this one.
Yeah, thank you.
Whoever wrote that question is a great question, by the way. Thank you. The likelihood of a cyber attack in the area is as likely as it would be in anywhere else. And the reason that is because in everybody's pocket sits a cellular phone that is more capable than a computer 10 years ago. And that's the bottom line. And they are now down to the age of 10, 11, and 12-year-olds to 80 to 85-year-olds carrying them. And there are more cell phones in the world than there are people. And that's a fact. What we've done to combat it is the FBI has developed cyber task forces. We've developed regional computer forensic laboratories. We've designated task force officers to combat cyber. The problem is oftentimes cyber crime is created, caused, and perpetrated outside of our reach. And that's an unfortunate truth. I don't know how many of you have received a letter or an email from the president of Nigeria, but he also owes me $16 million. I don't know how many of you have received a fake pop-up on your computer saying the FBI is watching and monitoring, but again, it's difficult to track these things because they move essentially at the speed of light. So what I say, and I open it to the panel for other opinions, is you have to be diligent with your online activity. You have to protect your PII, your personal identifiable information, your passcode. I go as so far as when I get gas at a gas station and I stick my credit card in, grab the little credit card access point and make sure there's not a skimmer put over it. Because we've had them in Santa Maria. We've had them up in this area as well. I think there was one up in Paso Robles where skimmers were used. So you have to be diligent. It's something the FBI is working very hard at, I promise you that. It's our number three priority, and when you consider the first two are counterintelligence and terrorism, that ranks pretty high. I know locally, which we're also part of and happy to be part of, I know Sheriff Parkinson and I at several meetings, we've talked about, correct me if I get the name wrong, but it's the High Crimes Task Force, and those are task forces looking to be created to attack this problem.
I know Cal Poly has broached the topic as well, and they're currently working with research laboratories to identify the problem. But it's difficult because, unfortunately, I hate to say it, we're playing catch-up in this game. We are playing catch-up. And as you saw most recently, we don't have, let me phrase this correctly here so I don't get fired next week. In light of the recent episode we had with Apple, you saw that some people believe in constitutional and personal rights trump those rights of national security. And I do not want to comment further on that, but you see what we're up against. So that's where I kind of leave it at. It's a growing problem. I throw back to the panel for any other comments.
Thank you. Mr. Petrone?
I can't help but add in on some of these things. One of the things that Brian talked about was he tried to remind you a lot of their responsibility. They're good. They're trying very hard. But if you allow yourselves to be vulnerable, well, guess what? You may become a victim. So they're doing what they can, but it is not, you can't shift the whole responsibility onto a national agency. We all have to be smarter. And your comment about the ATM or the skimmer at the gas station, these are things that unfortunately has become a part of our life and we have to get practice with. So good comments. Thank you.
If I may, if you'll just indulge me briefly, just to show the significance and the importance of this, the next time you put a movie or Blu-ray in, or DVD in, you used to receive the FBI warning. Everybody remember that? You're all familiar with the FBI mm-hmm. warning for piracy, mm-hmm. Title 18. If you look at it now, you'll notice there's a second emblem. And it's a funny joke running in the FBI because Director Comey first noticed that there's a second emblem next to his emblem. And of course, he got angry about that. Why is there another agency up there? But that just shows you the magnitude of where we're going and countering this. You'll also see Department of Homeland Security on there. You'll see Cyber Task Force on there. So it's a problem that's being addressed by every agency, investigative-wise, but it's also being addressed by every local agency to include municipalities such as San Luis Obispo as well as county sheriff's offices.
Again, one more thing, as much as we talk, and I think there's a question perhaps coming up about preparations that we can each do, this is an area where we all need to prepare for what happens if your connection to the cyber world is interrupted. And that can manifest itself in lots of ways. Luckily, we're in a part of the world where our daily existence is relatively simple. And I think we're a very inherently resilient community. It's been my experience so far. But this is going to be something that we all have to think about is what do you do when the cell phones don't work and you can't see the web and all your digital support stuff doesn't work? It's a reversion to a time that we've lost. We need to think about what we do.
Follow-up question on that, and it has to do with creating a family plan. What do you personally plan? And I'm hoping that Mr. Alsup might consider answering this question to start with. It says, many families have plans to deal with a home fire or earthquake. How would a family develop a plan for a community incident disaster? Is there a website with resources?
And is there a live mic?
Yeah.
It should be right
there. Right
next
this
to you.
Slide. Hello. Great question, and both on the community aspect and a personal aspect. And, we've always heard the old-fashioned adage of have water, flashlights, and a battery-powered radio, and that still holds true. You know, as Jim just noted with, what happens when we lose all of our cyber and other things, as we might remember after the San Simeon earthquake, which as devastating as it was actually a moderate earthquake. Unfortunately, the two fatalities were certainly a tragedy, but a 6.5 earthquake and cell phones were gone. So we do need to prepare for that, but the personal preparedness is there is information in both the Red Cross's website and our website, probably easier than giving the long government website address, is to search for San Luis Obispo County OES or just SLO County OES. And it pops on our site with some pretty significant preparedness efforts. Locally, as far as community and family preparedness, American Red Cross puts on community preparedness presentations. They will come to various communities and give preparedness. They have some great preparedness information themselves. And finally, I agree grants throughout the county, and this is under the auspices of the Fire Chiefs Association, but also primarily through the Sheriff's Advisory Foundation and Sheriff Parkinson, is the community emergency response teams throughout the county are growing. We have a North Coast community emergency response team. We have one in Estero Bay for Cayucas, Morro Bay, and a Baywood Park, Los Sosos area. San Luis Obispo has regular community emergency response training. So one part of the answers for individual preparedness is there a place to go? Yes. You know, again, you can search for Slo County OES, another on Google or whatever search engine you want to use. Another easy one to remember at the federal level is ready.gov. Again, ready.gov is a good source. And then while we're on the subject of preparedness and stuff, one thing I want to encourage people to do is a system run through the sheriff's office is a reverse 911. If you have an old-fashioned copper phone line, you will get notified in a reverse 911. That's if something happens, if there's an evacuation in a certain area, or even things, too, like if there's a serious challenge for a very serious Alzheimer's patient who's in danger, the local notifications can go out. But cell phones, you need to register that. You know, you can find that information, again, on our website or on the sheriff's website, and we encourage people to register for reverse 911 as well. And on a final note, for those that currently have old-fashioned plain copper phone lines, despite the extra expense, it's not that much. We'd encourage people to keep those. And in fact, in our office, an actual requirement of the position for emergency services coordinators is you must maintain a home phone. So I hope that answers that question. Did I miss anything on it?
Well, we have another question that's related because you mentioned it. But then, is there anyone else who would like to?
I defer to the expert.
To the expert. Mm-hmm. Does the expert know the answer to this question then?
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. You know, for the local ones, it's probably easier for the, well, here I can give what the county one is if since you're writing it down. It's now you're going to catch me off guard here. www.co.slo.ca.us. And you know what? That one. I'll tell you what. Let's do the Google search for Slo County, sir. If you can do Slo County Government or Slo County OES, that website will come up. And when you get to the county government website, look under departments. You can look for Sheriff's Department and Emergency Services. But as you can see by my flustering here, it is a long, convoluted email address for the local ones. Does that help you, sir?
I can give you more that's a little simpler. You all know the League of Women Voters. So lwvslo.org.
Great.
lwvslo.org. And
right.
Associated with the same question is a CERT, C-E-R-T program in place? That's Community Emergency Response Training. How effective is your current public alert methods?
So that's a question, the CERT and the current and the public alert message. There are a number of CERT programs throughout the county, as I noted a bit ago, that they are growing. It's a growing program, ranging from an absolutely outstanding CERT program up on the North Coast CERT up in Cambria. They're very self-sustaining. There are a number of others in the North County, as well as I mentioned, Estero Bay from Morro Bay, and then San Luis Obispo puts on training. But where we're almost to a point of all the CERT organizations within the county are coming together and forming a nonprofit organization. So we're a little bit, we're not quite there yet to have a countywide contact for the CERT, unless, Sheriff Parkinson, you have an update on that.
No, I don't, but I want to add something that's kind of important. So Ron mentioned all the different CERT teams, and there's another one is getting ready to form in the Pismo Beach, kind of the South County area. Okay. And so what we've done, we formed a task force, and the task force has actually bought them their equipment. The most important thing that we bought them is radios to communicate. So I mentioned the EOC earlier and the coordination. Sitting at the EOC in a disaster is the local ham radio operators. So when we talk about communication breakdowns, we talk about any major event where you lose your cell towers or your cell towers are impacted to such a degree you cannot communicate, so you have to rely on a older, probably more reliable piece of communication, and that is ham radios. So all of our CERT teams that are currently functioning have radios and a method to communicate to the ham radio operator in the EOC during disaster. So the idea is now they are dispatched or located just like a fire department, police department, sheriff's office would be out in the field, and so that program is expanded. Sorry, Ron.
No, thank you for that, Sheriff. And if I could side note real quick, now that I've got my senses about me, and the sheriff gave me a chance to pull out my computer, more powerful than the desk ones were 10 years ago, the address for the county government is www.slocounty.ca.gov, and you need to use the www I found. So www.slocounty.ca.gov. And then once there, you'll see a pull-down menu for departments. And you can look up Sheriff's Department and Emergency Services. And tying that in with the second question regarding our public alert notification systems is on our page, on the County OAS page, there's a particular information page that is how would you be notified in an emergency. So, again, if you want to go to that web page I mentioned in search, there's all kinds of information on there. But in summary, the public alert in our county is we have a number of systems. We have the emergency alert system, which is a system where we broadcast, interrupts AM, FM, AM and FM radio broadcasters, television broadcasters, cable TV, so Charter in our particular case. We have, as many of you may have received last week, a wireless emergency alert on the cell phones, and the one I'm referencing last week was the kidnapping out of Soledad, or the car that was stolen with the child in it. And then when that tone that came across, that message on our cell phones was a wireless emergency alert system. We had the capability to activate that here locally. And then we also have, as I mentioned, the reverse 911. Within the Diablo Canyon Emergency Planning Zone, we have the early warning system sirens, 131 sirens that can be used for any type of a notification. And so we have a number of systems. We also have, the Weather Service has their national the National Weather Service alert radios, which can also transmit emergency alert systems. In fact, I was just talking with Supervisor Dr. Bresch's operations chief about that during the break, is we're actually buying for some of the smaller care homes and whatnot weather radios so they can receive emergency alert system messages. And we would encourage people to buy that, too, for weather emergencies. So we have a number of ways of getting hold of people. There's also the going the door-to-door. In fact, and with the tsunami that was mentioned earlier, when we had the tsunami 5 years ago, sheriff's department, police department, fire guys actually went along the coastline and went door-to-door. And then we have other evacuation messages. And when a good portion of Santa Margarita was evacuated for the fire this past summer, you know, law enforcement just went through the neighborhoods and evacuated the folks. So we have a pretty redundant notification system, and I'll close it with encouraging people to indeed register for reverse 911.
Thank you very much. Thank Anyone you. Else like to add to the very thorough explanation?
Thank you.
This one has to do with Cal Poly, and I would say Cuesta would be new. If a person with a grudge and a gun were to start shooting on Cal Poly's campus, are you prepared to handle this? Are the students? Sheriff Parkinson, would you like to start?
Certainly. So the last 2 years, one of the things that we've been doing is we've been examining all the schools throughout the county and preparing our response. So if you think about the events that occur in an active shooter, the first most important thing is that we can get there, and we can get there to the right spot and stage the right resource. So what we have done is we have spent thousands of dollars to map out every school within the county. I think with a few real small exceptions, a couple of the private ones, and we have mapped them onto a diagram with response locations, with staging areas, alternatives, emergency contact for the schools, who has the keys to the school, including Cal Poly and Cuesta. And the plan is, and we're probably, I would say, in the next 3 to 4 months of rolling all of them out to all law enforcement and fire personnel in the county. And they will have them on their computers and their cars. They will be updated because it'll be hosted on our server at the sheriff's office. And so you don't get that pull out these 10 pages and put new ones in. Everything that comes up on the computer will be the most recent. The other thing is protocols. We've discussed protocols. We're unique in the sense that because of Diablo Canyon, the sheriff has a supervisor on the desk 24/7 at my EOC or at my communication center, And so in the event of a shooting, having a supervisor on the desk has the ability to open up the book and look at the response and actually coordinate people coming in. So it's a pretty robust system, and it definitely includes Cal Poly and Cuesta. Now, you can imagine the size of Cal Poly compared to Napomo High School, our first one that we did. There's a big, you know, difference, big disparity between the two. However, the general idea of where it is occurring on campus and how do we get resources in there and respond is really what's targeting when you get a campus that big.
Would someone care to comment on, are the students prepared?
I can comment on the K-12 students.
Excellent.
And
thank
as a
you.
Faculty member of Poly, how I was involved. We do practice. We practice various levels of drills for emergency preparedness with students. And those have changed. If you think of students in the schools in the 50s and 60s, it was, you know, get under your desk for the bomb. It's very different. Even our methods in which it was shelter in place has changed to protocols that the law enforcement is advising us. So every school in the county, even the private and parochial schools, practice disaster awareness with the student population. I was noticing the little box that's on the table here in front of the dais, and each of our schools has that emergency box provided by Office of Emergency Services to communicate throughout the county. So we have that networking. The protocols that the sheriff spoke of are discussed at each campus in the K-12 community, and they're slightly different. You may have a lockdown code, or you may have a shelter in place at different schools. And I've been involved in a bomb threat, armed robber that entered into school campus, and then a closure of a campus because of a chemical leak in North County. All of those protocols were different at the school. And for the most part, the students do a better job than the adults. Our biggest challenge, honestly, is the parent population not letting us put the emergency protocols in place. The recent incident at Templeton completely clogged the arteries in and out of the area because people showing up to transport students on and off. That is a challenge that we grapple with all the time on a daily basis, just transportation in front of our schools. But in an emergency, it's heightened.
Thank you. Yes.
Once again, it's pounding the same old drum here, but this goes back to the individual responsibilities. The parents need to know what these protocols are and need to know what they can do to support them and know that some of the actions might actually hinder the responses. So this is a big part of his job, is to try to communicate, but people have to listen, and that's a hard, hard thing to do. So.
Right. We have to be empathetic. We have to understand. And being a parent myself, your natural instinct is to protect your children. So we have to plan and be proactive to respond to that. I don't think we can ever 100% say that the people aren't going to enter our properties when there's an emergency. How do we best respond? How do we treat people? How do we exit the student population safely? Have to rely on law enforcement, and they're looking at our properties, examining our floor plans, our exit flows, the arteries in and out. Every school is different. If you look at Paso Robles, there are five schools on one road. Five schools. We have to rely on city engineers, transportation, the city police, as well as the sheriff's department to advise us.
I was just going to add one last thing. Agent Sullivan mentioned it earlier. Remember, we have cell phones in every pocket, and that is a challenge for us, that every single parent out there knows more about what's going on than we do, because we're not communicating directly with their children. So we're getting information from the school that may or may not have somebody on the ground. The parents arriving know because their child has been texting them. And if you've ever seen a 12-year-old text under the table without looking, it can be done. It's been done at my dinner table many a time. So it's amazing what they can do with those. And so we're responding to a call that the parents know more about it. And then it's a second disaster when they start arriving because of concern for their child.
If I may just add one point on this, which I think the three of you gentlemen handled that very nicely. But the key I'd like to emphasize is we experienced this with the Atascadero incident very clearly. That happened last September 11th, as a matter of fact, a memorial to the incident that occurred. If I could convey one point, it's simply this. You must, as a parent, as a member of the community, you must rely on the fact that the agencies that are responding and working the schools are highly trained. I need to implore that you have confidence in what they're doing is correct. The staff members at the schools are some of the most impressive I've seen. I've seen what they have done and have confidence to know that your child's interest is first and foremost on their mind. So just instill confidence to know what's going on. I'm sorry we cannot get information out as quickly as you would like it, but just know the best actions are being taken. That's the only message I'd like to convey.
Thank you. The next question has to do with Diablo. Since the Belgian terrorists were trying to infiltrate nuclear power plants, I want to know if prospective Diablo Canyon employees are carefully vetted and the plant itself secure. We'll start with Agent on that, and Sheriff, you might want to come in. We have several PG&E representatives here also.
Thank you very much. I don't want to deflect or parry this, but I think that'd be best handled by PG&E.
Let's start with PG&E. Michael, we have two. You can choose. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Corey George, and just to throw a little background for you, I was pay call firefighter for Station 20 down in Napomo. I then progressed to an EMT down at the city of Inglewood and in San Luis Obispo County. I'm a graduate of Allen Hancock's Law Enforcement Academy. At that point, I moved on to Diablo Canyon Security. I was a nuclear security officer for several years and then progressed to a security sergeant or response team leader. I also was part of Diablo Canyon's adversary team. So I was tasked with actually attacking the plant and seeing how far I could get along with it. It's professional-grade laser tag, so it was a lot of fun. With that, I had the opportunity to travel to other plants, mock attack their plants as well. Every plant I went to was given a job offer because the respect that was given to Diablo Canyon's security force. As far as your question about Diablo Canyon and how we vet our employees, every employee is screened, thorough background. It also is progresses to an FBI background, so we do drug tests, criminal tests, background checks, and credit checks, fingerprint scans, and such. That is repeated on a continuous basis. Every employee is under a 30-day observation program by their supervisor, so anytime during that 30 days, the supervisor gets asked, is the employee fit for duty? Are they continually monitored? If you, as a supervisor, do not have contact with that employee under 30 days, the employee loses their status to the plant until a supervisor can observe them and confirm that they're still under the behavior observation program. So we are very thorough about that. On top of that, we also have random testing, and that random testing is done for drug screening and alcohol screening to ensure that no employee at any time is operating at the plant unfit for duty. On top of that, I would like to go into unclassified version of our defensive posture. So any person that comes into our plant, they are screened. Even if our sheriff comes out to the plant, we have to know about it beforehand. He can't show up at our front door without us effectively inviting him in. If we have an event, obviously the sheriff comes in and we work in that fashion. Every individual who comes through our plant, whether they're an employee or a visitor, goes through a further screening process. We check their identification. It goes through a national database to ensure that they're not disallowed from entering the plant. At that point, once we have allowed that person to come into the plant, they have to go through a metal detector and an explosive detector, and all their materials go through explosive testing and x-ray testing. Every employee is vetted with a picture identification card, which has an ability to be read at our entrance turnstiles. That has to be matched biometrics. At that point, they're allowed to enter into our protected area. All visitors are maintained with a key carded individual who has the ability to enter through the plant. Outside defensives, we have continuing monitoring of the plant. We have it through outside patrol officers who are armed officers. We also have camera systems. We have fencing. We also have intrusion detection system. This is a multiple redundant system. Inside the plant, we have multiple officers staged in hardened facilities. They are all armed officers. They are also carrying sidearms, and they carry an anti-vehicle weapon. Inside the plant, we have more officers who have outside perimeter locations, and then they also have inside fallback positions. All of that's monitored 24/7, and we have a minimum staff at all times.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to speak about Diablo? Chair?
I'll just add a couple things. It's true that they won't let me on the plant without announcing. That's not what I was going to add, but the description you got is probably a declassified description. It's pretty impressive what they have inside Diablo to protect the plant. On the outside, we have the responsibility of both the FBI and the Sheriff's Office responding to the plant in an event. It's something that's rehearsed. We have, like the nuclear drills, we also have a hostile action drill that is many agencies are participating in. We have a response plan to Diablo and all venues, all ways into the plant. That is also rehearsed, and with our law enforcement partners. The chief mentioned the regional SWAT team. The sheriff's office has a SWAT team as well, and both teams have actually practiced and rehearsed response to Diablo. So it's something that's done every day. And the last thing, we also monitor Diablo Canyon with cameras, courtesy of Diablo Canyon at our watch commander's office 24/7. So we, when there is an event, we can actually look and tell as well. And then there's many other things that are done that we cannot discuss. Otherwise, Brian will probably haul me off and declassify me in some fashion. But we are constantly working with our intelligence, my intelligence officer, with Brian's people on what is going on with the plant.
Thank you. Mr. Petroni?
Yeah, coming back to the vetting issue. Understand that as much as we are concerned about that, rest assured PG&E is even more concerned. I mean, they are the potential, very vulnerable potential victim of an internal worker attack or incident. PG&E pays pretty well. Those are very desired jobs, so they don't have to take everybody who applies. So they're going to be picky, and part of that pickiness is looking reasonably, depending upon the position, into about the background. They do the national agency checks and they monitor their people. So this is part of that preventive aspect that we talked about, but addresses the vetting issue particularly. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yes.
I just wanted to add something. I think it's important that we focus too on the bulk of issues where we have some sort of violent action. It's almost always related to mental health. And we sometimes drift away from that if you look at especially the violence in our schools, whether it's Columbine, whether you go back to Sandy Hook, you're dealing with issues of mental health as a society. I think our law enforcement agencies, our agencies such as PG&E, do an excellent job screening, but we have to raise awareness about in the public regarding the mental health of all of our citizens to prevent some of these issues.
Thank you. A point well taken. The last question of the evening has to do with transportation. Traffic on US 101. What plans are in place for traffic congestion and accidents in the event of an incident or an emergency at Diablo Canyon?
Call upon
Mr. Alsa.
at it. Thank you. I'll take the first stab at it, and if others have anything to add, then that would be great. We have within part of our Diablo Canyon emergency planning process what are called standard operating procedures. So we have our big master plan, the San Luis Obispo County City's nuclear power plant emergency response plan. And within that, basically an umbrella under that are what we standard operating procedures. There are 51 standard operating procedures, County Office of Education, Sheriff's Office, for functions like public information, and so on. City of Cisco is included in that. One of those is for the California Highway Patrol. And as part of the evacuation staging process, they have predetermined what they call traffic control points. They have it down to how many officers that they would need in a certain area. Maybe one officer at Avila Drive, at San Luis Bay Drive. They even have it down to what the patrol car radio identifier would be when they're calling back in. So that's done throughout the area on the traffic control basis. One of the positions staffed in the Emergency Operations Center that Sheriff Parkinson was talking about that we're all face-to-face is Caltrans is in there, the CHP's in there, and, of course, the Sheriff's Office and others. So all this traffic control is being coordinated. We also have, as a federal requirement for PG&E for operating the plant, they're required to hire professional traffic engineers and consulting firms to develop what's called an evacuation times estimate. So we have a document that's actually 500 pages on how long it would take to evacuate around Diablo. Not the length of a document's indicative of anything, otherwise we'd have the greatest tax code in the world. Within that document, it's about 316 or so different scenarios on what if the car show is going on Pismo Beach and we have to evacuate, and so on. But what if a road's blocked? So part of the process, if we do have to evacuate, one, we know how long it's going to take the people to get out of there. Two, the CHP has all numerous traffic control points set up. They would need more officers than we have in the county, but that's set up as well. They would come into the county, go out to Camp San Luis, get what we call just-in-time training, including we have a predetermined DVD. As I noted, within the procedures that they have, they're actually checklists. Here, Officer Jones, up to this point, here's your checklist. Your instruments to monitor you for radiation. Other than that, there are also other extensive plans within the CHP and Caltrans is that coming into our county, 101, the highways would be closed off. So as far south as King City, just turn off below King City, over to Kalinga, up to Gilroy, southbound 101 might be closed, certainly be diverted off, closed at 166, and also as far south as Ventura. So with that would limit it to the traffic that's already in our as far as evacuations. So we do take this into effect, and as the sheriff has seen many times at the command table with the CHP, the command table is where the main group of folks sit in our Emergency Operations Center to make decisions. The CHP is right there, and they discuss traffic control points, how many officers would be needed, and we take that into consideration before an evacuation. And a final note on all of this is the road blockage in CHP investigations. Ironically, I was just reading a state legislative report 1987, and they're asking the then CHP officer, which a CHP captain for the area, Max Van Orsdale, what would happen if the roadway's blocked. And as he noted at the time, he said, we do a lot of things. We do a traffic investigation right now, wait for the tow truck and try and clean up the scene. And he said, in an emergency, what we're going to do, this was 1987 and it's still valid today, use the push bars and the patrol cars to move things. We've had occasionally, we see these semi-trucks in an accident. There was one south of San Luis Obispo a number of years ago, and we actually practiced, okay, semis blocking the roadway, waiting for a big rig tow. Then we went to Cal Fire and said, how soon can you get a bulldozer down there? And 20, 30 minutes, push that thing off the road. So there are all kinds of contingency plans for the traffic control point. So we know within that document how long it would take to evacuate folks. Another aspect of this, it's not like a railroad accident where a chlorine tank car comes off the rails and ruptures and you better get out of the way like right now. This is, for lack of a better term, a buildup period. Oops, plant broke. We better activate the Emergency Operations Center. PG&E, what's going on at the plant? Might it get worse? And this all happens in the Emergency Operations Center and in alternate facilities that PG&E has. And we look at that and we project, and our mantra within the county is to move people ahead of time. In fact, we've been criticizing in drills for evacuating too soon. So we want to move people out of the area. If the situation gets worse at the plant, then we can start to moving more people out of the area. And to put it in context of the time frame, in the CHP standard operating procedure I mentioned, they actually have in there, if area is being evacuated and CHP units, anybody back in, You can't, and this is direction to the officers, you can let residents go back in to pick up, you know, pets and stuff. And so this is the kind of thing we're talking about. It's not like, oops, plant broke, we need to evacuate Dodge City right now. It's the kind of thing where there's a build-up period, we have time to get people out, and it is done in an organized fashion with our planning process.
Thank you very much, and I'd like to thank our panelists. We greatly appreciate your time and your expertise to help us be prepared. Can we all appreciate?
Thank you.
Thank you, audience, for your great questions and your great attention. And I'd like to remind you to pick up one of these little tiny books. It says, profile of an active shooter, what to do, how to respond. Nice little thing to have. And the League of Women Voters thanks you. Good night.
Thank you. You're welcome.